Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. As always, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth. And actually, this is more like Ruby Friday. We're coming to you late this week because I've been sick and lost my voice for about 2 days. However, there has just been too much news to not have a podcast. So today, we're going to court. There's a new class action lawsuit filed by former NFL players against the league involving painkiller misuse. There's what appears to be a brewing legal war between the NBA and LA Clippers owner in exile, slash despicable human being, slash du jour magazine aficionado, Donald Sterling. There's yet another lawsuit brought by former cheerleaders against an NFL team, which is something I wrote about this week and we talked about on the podcast 2 weeks ago. There are also some major new developments in the Ed O'Bannon antitrust case against the NCAA, which could actually go to trial in a couple of weeks. And last but not least, in another recurring topic on this podcast, there was a district court ruling in Missouri last week that could, and I say could, lead to discovery against the NFL regarding what it knew and when it knew it about concussions. And that could happen regardless of what happens with the ongoing settlement, which continues to be a train wreck. So joining me to make sense of all this, and it's a lot, is Rand Getlin, who's a legal analyst for Yahoo Sports, a frequent guest on Jim Rome's TV show, and also one of my favorite Twitter follows because he seldom pulls punches on all these topics. You could say that Rand keeps it real. Rand, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Patrick. Thanks for having me, sir.
So let's. It's great to have you. I've always wanted to have you on. Let's start with the newest news, which is this painkiller lawsuit. For everybody listening, here's the quick basics. Eight retired players, including Richard Dent and Jim McMahon, who you may remember from the beloved 85 Chicago Bears, they filed a federal class action lawsuit against the league this week, accusing the NFL of illegally supplying them and other players with dangerous pain-killing and anti-inflammatory drugs that did allow them to play through injuries, but also resulted in addiction and physical harm. Now, I'm sure you're thinking out there, okay, painkillers, anti-inflammatories, using these medicines by professional athletes is not exactly unheard of. And that's true. And in the abstract, using medicine is not a good or a bad thing necessarily. But this case is very specific, and we should go back to that word illegal. Basically, what the ex-players are accusing team doctors operating under the NFL umbrella of doing is, and I'm going to quote, intentionally, recklessly, and negligently creating and maintaining a culture of drug misuse, substituting players' health for profit. Now, if we break that down a little bit more, these players, and by the way, they say they have about 500 others ready to join them. These players in the suit say they were not informed of the health risks that came with using these particular drugs, whether they were in isolation or used in combination. And that's important. We'll get back to that in a minute. Moreover, the players say that these team doctors deployed and prescribed the drugs in an unethical, unsafe, and potentially illegal manner. So, Rand, you've seen the suit, you've seen the allegations, you've seen the news. How strong and serious do you think this is on its face?
Well, it's an issue. I mean, there are multiple issues that you're going to have to get into in terms of the NFL's defenses and how they're going to be able to get around this. Chief among them, they're going to say, listen, this was collectively bargained to. We were allowed to prescribe certain painkillers. We did, in fact, prescribe those painkillers as was collectively bargained. And, you know, you can't come back now and be angry at us for misuse along the way. The issue, however, is what is being alleged could constitute a criminal act or multiple criminal acts under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. This is an issue about whether there was fraudulent conduct, which the player side, the plaintiffs, would argue is well outside the scope of anything that could be collectively bargained to, i.e. the court can't allow collective bargaining processes. You can't opt out of fraud claims in the future. You can't collectively agree to, we'll never be able to bring a fraud claim in the future. So, you know, what's interesting is the case seems to be strong on its face. We all know that there has, at least in an abstract sense, that there's tremendous amount of drug use in the NFL. For instance, there's a lot of focus on Toradol a few years back, and there's a young man at USC, Armin, his last name is Armstead, Armin Armstead, and or Armon Armstead, and he brought a claim against USC saying essentially, listen, they shot me up with Toradol. I was a completely healthy NFL prospect. I ended up having a heart attack. I believe it was as a result of the Toradol because there's no other explanation. And it did, in fact, impact my NFL career. The kid ended up going undrafted, I believe, had to play in the CFL when he was at one point looked at as a first or second round NFL draft pick. Now, it has somewhat of a happy ending insofar as the kid made it back to the Patriots and is now in the NFL, still dealing with some injury issues. But there's still this question, did this tour at all contribute to a heart attack? Well, that's one isolated incident. In the NFL, tour at all has been used for decades. And so, you know, this is a drug that people knew was very dangerous, and yet it was being prescribed, often seemingly outside of the bounds of what it was supposed to be prescribed for, how it was supposed to be used. And so the question becomes, can the plaintiffs attach any liability to the NFL for allowing them to use the drugs, for encouraging them to use the drugs, and for allegedly prescribing them the drugs outside of any legal construct? So, you know, is it a strong case? It certainly seems to be a colorable claim on its face. But as with all of these things, it's complicated, so you want to see when they kind of get into the meat of it where it stands. But if they can prove, you know, half of the allegations that they've laid out, certainly not going to be a good thing for the NFL. And as we've seen before, they are open to settling these kinds of things because the stain on the game and the damage to the brand can be considerable.
Yeah, and I think you're right about that. And I'm glad you mentioned Toradol. I want to dig into that a little bit with you because in a lot of ways, I think that specific drug and what has happened in the NFL with that drug, it sort of is a window into this case in general. And a window into, like you said, what the players are claiming, how strong their claims may be, and what the NFL may or may not be able to do to defend themselves. You know, I'm glad you brought the CBA defense because that sounds a lot like the concussion lawsuits. The NFL's first move was gonna say this is a CBA matter, this is a labor matter. It should be remanded to that. It should be remanded to arbitration essentially, which is always much more favorable to corporations and employers. That's a court where the NFL would like the ball to go. We never got to see, by the way, in the federal consolidated concussion cases, whether or not the judge was going to buy that argument for some or all of those cases, because the settlement was announced before she had to rule on CBA preemption, which is interesting and actually ties into something we're going to get to later. But speaking of Toradol here. Again, for listeners who aren't totally aware, I want to give you a little background. So Toradol is a post-operative anesthetic, essentially. It's a fairly dangerous drug in that some European countries actually ban it. It's supposed to be used after you have surgery in a short course for post-operative pain. It's been, you said, Randy, you're right. It's been used in the NFL for decades. I mean, we have stories in the lawsuit and outside the lawsuit of players lining up pants down before games to get shots, which tells you they weren't just using it, by the way, and this is important. They weren't just using it, you know, after a game, during a week, after a knee injury to deal with pain. They were using it prophylactically. They were taking it before games so they could go out there, get hit, get hurt, and not feel pain in the first place.
Right.
That's important. Hold on to that thought for a second. They were also stacking Toradol with other drugs, including other what's called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Toradol is one of those. Advil is one of those. There's quite a few of those. All those drugs have dangerous properties for the kidneys. They have blood-thinning properties. You have to be careful how you use them and careful how you stack them. You don't want to take too many or too many together. NFL players were using Toradol week after week after week. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because if you look at the FDA warning label for this drug, again, you don't need to be a pharmacologist. Go look at the warning label. It says you do not use this drug prophylactically before surgery. You do not use it if there's a chance of bleeding. Because like I said, it's a blood thinner. So, you know, or trauma. So for instance, you're going to go out and play a football game where you're going to get hit and bruised and rattled around a lot. It may not be a good drug to use. You do not use this drug, according to the FDA, for more than 5 days. And you should not be combining it with other similar non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for the reasons we mentioned. Also, this is not on the warning label, but if you do a little bit of research, you can see that this Toradol, specifically, there's some research that suggests it can make the damage from concussions and head trauma in your brain that much worse because it can encourage easier bleeding, and at a microscopic level. So for all those reasons, like, to me, it's like, wow, I can't believe you give this drug to football players in the first place. But also, you know, what, NFL doctors, can they not read FDA warning labels? To me, that right there seems like a pretty strong case. Like, this is a drug that probably shouldn't have been administered, that definitely probably should have been administered in combination with other drugs. And, you know, a lot of players will tell you they wanted this drug, they took this drug to perform, but they weren't told the risks.
Right.
How strong, just on the basis of Toradol alone, are these claims, if these things are true?
Well, you know, there's the problem with Toradol. First of all, everything you said is obviously factually correct in terms of the dangers of the drug. As a precursor to the deeper discussion matter, Toradol, as I'm told by multiple sources who've been working on a project, related to its use in college, was brought down from the NFL as coaches kind of went back and forth between college programs and NFL programs. Mm-hmm. They brought Toradol with them down to the college level. For instance, at USC, obviously, Lane Kiffin had some experiences in the NFL. And all of a sudden now kids at the school are using Toradol. And it's like you said, they're using it in order to play through pain or in order to avoid, if they do experience injury, feeling anything while they're on the field. And so, as I understand it, Armstead down at USC was using it, I believe, in order to help them with a shoulder mm-hmm. injury. So it starts earlier now, right? It's not just in the NFL. Well, that's one of the issues. It's a causation issue. You know, when did the Toradol use begin? Is it the NFL's problem that this kid was injured or this adult was injured in this way? Because, you know, how do we know where it began? And so causation issues from a legal standpoint are always very problematic, especially with drugs like this that have long-term effects. Mm-hmm. You cannot necessarily pin down how a specific injury or episode ties back to a specific instance of being injected with Toradol or taking this pill or whatever it may be. And so, you know, these are always difficult issues. Again, when you look at it, even though the causation issues are problematic, as you go through the discovery phase, you find a lot of information that you can get away from kind of the causation issue saying, you know, what they're alleging in part is that you, in a wrongful way, got us addicted to illegal narcotics, right? And you're prescribing them to us outside of that. So that's what they're focused on, not necessarily that the use of this drug caused this specific injury and then this one on. So it's a little bit more amorphous. And from that standpoint, certainly, if you can show, look, I was never using Toradol until I got to the league, and then all of a sudden they started pushing Toradol on me consistently so that I could go out there and play. And of course, as a gladiator, I was going to follow the team's edict and take the Toradol, and I did, in fact, go out there and play. And now, what do you know? I'm addicted to illegal narcotics. You know, surprise, surprise. This is something that happens in society on a daily basis. Imagine if you, as an average citizen, were prescribed very strong drugs with the potential for high potential for addiction, and they were pushed on you consistently just so you could perform in your day-to-day job duties. You know, it'd be a lot more addiction issues on that side as well for civilians. So I think, you know, in terms of their ability to really wake the league up with this case, though it's kind of quiet right now, you see this all the time. When there's not much understanding about what's going on and there's so many murky issues, people kind of tend to stay away from it, especially in the sports journalism realm.
Right.
But as people dig into this and really see what's being alleged here, and these players are able to kind of get some of their stories out into the mainstream, I really do think this could be an issue that causes a lot of problems for the NFL, just for the simple fact that they care so much about protecting the shield and protecting the brand. And though Roger Goodell et al. May not be responsible for what was occurring in the 70s or even the early 80s, certainly those issues are now coming to a head. These guys are saying, look, this has been a problem that I've been dealing with my entire life, and it was caused by, in part, the NFL's actions here. And so, you know, proving that in a court of law is different than convincing the public that that's the case. And so the court of public opinion, when it comes to the NFL, can be just as powerful as a decision from the bench in a court of law, insofar as the NFL wants to stem the bleeding. They don't want this stuff playing out. They just want people paying attention to the game. And it's a fantastic product, but as you've seen and many others have seen, you know, we enjoy the game, and I'm certainly one of those individuals. I love football. I came up watching football, but it's really, really difficult at this point to separate all these issues these players are facing. And this is one, we're talking about the medical realm here, but there's also the financial realm and so many other subsidiary issues that players deal with. You know, it's really hard to look at the game as just a game anymore. You know, there are just so many things out there. And I think that's what the NFL is going to be very sensitive to. And I know we're going to talk about this a little bit, but obviously with the concussion settlement in jeopardy and now discovery potentially being had down in Missouri, you know, they're dealing with a lot of attacks on a lot of fronts. And I think the NCAA, it gets the primary force of focus these days, you know, in terms of, geez, they're just attacks on all fronts, and they're collapsing sides. But the NFL is dealing with, you know, some pretty substantial risks as well. And I think that they're receiving less attention, largely because they're a little bit more complicated. But, you know, I'll have to see how it all plays out. And, you know, the court cases will play out over many years. And, you know, this is not going to be things that are determined expediently. So, you know, we'll see how it all plays out. But certainly this is not something that the NFL can just push aside and say we're not worried about it. It's an issue.
Well, I wonder, you know, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. I want to move back a little bit into something you were saying. You were talking about causation, and I agree. A lot of times when you're talking about causation of medical harm in the now, going back to past things, and especially when you're talking about long periods of time, complex interactions, in football where you're getting hit anyway, obviously that's a place where if you're the NFL and you're defending yourself, you really want to focus, because you're right. It can be very murky. The part to me, at least reading this lawsuit, and again, these are allegations. This is one side of things. But these allegations, I should note, I mean, they're very consistent with if you talk to current and former players on and off the record. If you read books that people have written, and not just former players, but former team doctors, there's nothing in the lawsuit that doesn't jive with what, as a journalist, I've been told and I've read, and a lot of other people have been told and read. I don't think that these claims are being pulled out of thin air. I found most of them fairly credible. So, it's, you know, with causation, like you said, that may be an issue, but the part to me that seems like it would be much harder for the NFL to defend is the idea of we hired these doctors, and or we let these doctors pay us for the privilege, the marketing privilege of working with our athletes, which is even worse and more ethically compromised. You know, but either way, these doctors working under our auspices, they acted in ways that seemed to be, at the very least, medically unethical, and possibly, if not probably, in violation of the Controlled Substances Act, or in violation of other sort of laws and regulations around, you know, improper medical care. Like I said, the reason I brought up the FDA warning label of Toradol is because, you know, to me, I think you can make a very good argument that this drug was being, you know, distributed and used outside of those recommendations. We talk about, in the suit, they talk about cocktailing drugs, which is essentially giving, these players combinations of drugs that are more dangerous when given in combination. And so we're not just talking about giving too much of a drug for too long of a period. We're talking about giving too many different drugs, and the side effects all compound each other. Also, these drugs being cocktailed with alcohol, I want to read you a small passage from the suit that I found really disturbing. And this, by the way, is another thing that jives with a lot of players' experiences. Here's from the suit. The players all receive the bulk of their pills, not in bottles that came with directions as to how they should be used, but rather in small manila envelopes that often had no directions or labeling. The players would receive the envelope and be told to take it. That's a little disturbing. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of informed consent there. That's not what happens if you go to CVS and go to the pharmacy for any of these kind of drugs. Another thing that was consistent with a lot of players' stories is that these guys would get on airplanes after playing on Sunday. They'd fly back home, and they'd be given these manila envelopes or given these drugs, and they'd be washing it down with beer on the plane. And most of these drugs don't interact very well with alcohol. In fact, that's a big no-no. And again, if you've ever gotten prescription for any of these drugs yourselves, you know that if you look at the warnings on there. So I think that's going to all be much harder for the NFL to defend. One other thing I want to ask you about from what you mentioned, the idea of addiction, right? So Toradol is actually not an addictive drug, but a lot of these drugs, the opioid painkillers in particular, the Vicodins, the Percocets, they're highly addictive. You can develop
Right.
a physical addiction to these drugs in as little as a week's time. Again, anyone who's ever gone to like get their wisdom teeth out, have you ever had your wisdom teeth out or anything like that?
I have not, thankfully.
Well, yeah, knock on wood. I've had a I had that happen to me. I got a small prescription for one of these opioid painkillers. It literally gave me like 2.5 days worth. I ran out of painkilling drugs way before I ran out of pain. And but that's intentional because these drugs, because they're so addictive, if you have a good doctor, they're going to be very cautious about how they prescribe them. They don't want to give you too many of these pills. They want to give you too few. And what you see in this lawsuit is like players essentially, you said, being turned into junkies. I mean, you see, they talk about how they became addicted and didn't even realize it. You even see, this is another disturbing thing that is not getting a lot of attention. Players describe getting these sort of daily regimens of drugs where they were getting uppers in the morning, big jars of amphetamines in the locker room in the 70s for anyone to take, into the 80s and 90s where they're getting these caffeine and other upper pills with sort of their morning meal. And then at night, they're getting Quaaludes, barbiturates, and now they're getting like Ambien, other really powerful sleep drugs, to sort of come down. To me, that's like conditioning someone to be a junkie. And you mentioned the NFL's public image issues. I think this could look really, really bad for the league. I mean, it looks like they're creating junkies. I tweeted this the other day. Maybe the best analogy is not that NFL players are roaming gladiators, but that NFL players are essentially prostitutes in a 19th century opium den. Do you think that's way off, or when you look at this suit, does that seem like kind of disturbingly on the mark?
Well, the reality is, I think your central point rings true in a lot of ways. If in fact, and again, these are all allegations, right? And so
Yeah, we should be
we'll see
clear about
how.
that.
Right, these are all allegations. But having heard plenty of stories from the older generation of football players that I've had the privilege of speaking with and kind of learning about their experiences, and then also, frankly, from speaking to younger guys who've been playing the game more recently, like this is drug culture is part of the game of football, right? And all of these guys need assistance to get through their day to day because it is just such a brutal game. So it would make a lot of sense that, especially in the 70s and 80s, and maybe even the early 90s, the latter 90s, there is less concern, I think, than there is now. Maybe
Sure.
in part due to a lack of understanding of how these things actually affect people in the long term, though somewhat how they affect people. I think that that very much sounds like my impression of what the 70s and 80s could have been like. Now, granted, I was born in at the end of 1982, so I have no frame of reference for what the 70s looked like. But that being said, it would not surprise me at all to find out that, yes, in fact, players were given uppers in the morning, and they were, in fact, given downers in the evening, and this was how they got by. Not only that, everybody was doing it, so why wouldn't you as well? You didn't see people falling off and dying from it, and so it didn't seem like a big deal. But yes, it is conditioning you then to become dependent upon drugs in order to get through your day to day. That, in and of itself, some would argue, is an evil. I take great pains to stay away from certain, for instance, coffee. Let's take the mildest form of stimulant you can find. A lot of people won't drink coffee, period, because they're afraid of becoming dependent upon it. Well, imagine if you're taking actual stimulants, ephedrine, and things that can in fact create physical addictions. But there's another element too, and this may not factor into the legal realm, but I think it's important and under discussed. It's not just physical addiction, right? It's mental addiction. And when I was speaking to players about the Toradol issue, they would tell me I felt like Superman. You know, when I
took
it,
I've heard the
I felt
same
like
thing.
I could do anything, right? And so it's not necessarily a physical addiction insofar as their body craves it, but they crave it. And mentally, they feel like they need it in order to be able to perform at their best. And by the way, all of these other guys are taking it. And so they're operating out there without any issues in terms of questioning whether they can perform because of nagging pain or acute pain. And so the mental addiction is, to me, also an element that should be discussed, though, again, from a legal standpoint. I have not researched whether that's something they can recover for.
Sure.
But, you know, the conditioning point, Patrick, is really important. So, again, here we run into causation, right? Are these guys using drugs before they got to the league? If so, what kinds of drugs? Obviously, we know in the 70s and the 80s, there was a large cocaine culture flowing around. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that if you're on the opposite side of the aisle, if you're on the NFL side, you would bring up. Look, you know, you cannot say that we created these addiction issues. These guys were using drugs then. So from a causation standpoint, it creates all kinds of problems if the NFL can come and say this player used, you know, X drug before he came here, and therefore we didn't leave that. But that being said, as you mentioned, and I think this is kind of the most important thing for the player's ability to recover, if they do in fact recover at all, is the NFL does not want a deep dive on just how institutionalized the drug culture was in their locker rooms, if it did.
And is. And is. Or allegedly is.
Right. So, I mean, it's, you know, you're looking at it, we're talking about, we're starting in the 70s. And, you know, the preemption issues, obviously, this is a big deal, too.
Mm-hmm.
For periods where the collective bargaining agreement wasn't in place, i.e. when the union was decertified or was not functioning as a bargaining unit, then, you know, the players would argue, well, look, there was no CBA. We didn't agree to anything during that time. We were operating as independent actors. And, you know, any claims that may arise during these dead periods, if you will, where there was no CBA controlling, you know, we can bring claims for those times. And you don't have a preemption defense. The NFL would probably say, you know, it extended beyond that point just because you weren't acting as a bargaining unit at that time. You know, the central tenets held through. All of that stuff is murky legal minutia. You know, you don't want to bog people down with that stuff. We'll see how it plays out. But from the standpoint of if they get to sharing these stories publicly and it becomes an issue where, like with League of Denial, somebody decides to do a deep dive and create a documentary that really lays out in great depth the nature of the drug culture in these locker rooms from the 70s all the way through, as you mentioned, present day, you're talking about an over 40-year period of institutionalized drug culture in what many would say is the greatest or most watched sport in America. And I think the league is really going to want to avoid that outcome.
I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head of what's sort of the biggest, most important point of this in terms of the big picture, not just the you know, individual players and their suffering, which is also really important, and sort of how that may resolve itself. But in terms of what does this sort of mean for the sport itself, I think you're right. The NFL, a lot of its popularity derives from it, you know, its image. I mean, it's like the most incredibly successful. You can make a case that the NFL, you know, essentially as a marketing company, and it's been the most successful marketing company the last half century in America. And so much of that is dependent on its image, and so much of that is dependent on being seen as wholesome, all-American. You know, the NFL is an MMA. It isn't boxing. It isn't some, you know, tawdry blood sport. It's something that Madison Avenue is more than happy to attach itself to. It's something that middle America can wrap its arms around and take into its heart. You know, it's Roger Goodell and Colin Powell reading the Declaration of Independence before the Super Bowl. You know, it's wrapping itself in the flag and Americana and all that stuff. That's the NFL. That's the great trick they've pulled, marketing-wise. You know, it's Friday Night Lights. It's all those things, right? Football's done that in this country. If it starts to look like that you've got this huge drug culture, and by the way, it's ironic that we were talking about the, you know, the Robert Mathis stuff right before this broke, and the alleged performance-enhancing drug use. But if you go this drug culture where these drugs are not performance-enhancing, but you have to basically become a painkiller addict or take these drugs in all sorts of off-label uses or take uppers and downers and all these things, basically as performance enablers, That's a very bad look, not just for your league, but for your sport. And I think you're right. I don't think the NFL wants people to have to think too hard or too long about any of that. Let me ask you one last question really fast before we move on to Sterling. If one thing about this is we didn't talk much about the team doctors and or the team medical providers. Now some of these doctors are private practices, things like that, but sometimes we're talking about pretty big time medical institutions, and some of them are attached to like universities, medical schools. If you're one of those big medical institutions, big hospitals in a city, a university medical school, and you're involved with providing NFL medicine, and let me just say that let's say you're a legal counsel for one of them. What are you thinking when you look at this lawsuit? Are you thinking like, uh-oh, this could be a really big can of worms?
Yeah, I mean, so that's one issue, right? From a raw legal standpoint, a liability standpoint, can we be held liable for the actions of the NFL or for our cooperation with them in certain regards and the administering of these drug programs? Well, you know, that is really murky because now the further away you get from the center, the further away you get from the drug provider, if you will, the more difficult it becomes to attach direct liability, though obviously you can do that, but again, the further out from the center of the circle you get, the more difficult it becomes. But I think there's a deeper question, and you know, step away from the legal counsel at these schools. It's more a moral and ethical question.
Yeah,
Now,
that's what I was going to, I was driving at that. Go on.
yeah, it's just, you know, if you are, and I'm not a doctor, but the Hippocratic Oath, as I understand it, and I don't know how to recite it verbatim, but I think the gist of it is, look, we're going to take care of people. We're going to ensure that we do what's best for them, and we're going to make sure that we provide them with the best healthcare coverage possible, you know, in terms of saving lives, ensuring that people live healthy lives, et cetera. And we're going to be free of ethical conflicts, you know, et cetera, or attempt to be that way. You know, how do you stand by, for instance, when you look at the NFLPA and NFL debacle with Harvard that was discussed? You know, this money that was sent over there, $500 million for concussion research, and then you find out that it's actually not $500 million, and who knows what happened. Some people said the NFLPA was misleading or was lying
They're
about the
not, you
nature of
know,
what's happening.
I've tried to contact Harvard to get the specifics of what they're doing with that study, what their plans are, how the money's going to be spent, what other research goals, what are their objectives, all those things. They wouldn't tell me anything. Not a word. They declined. That's really unusual. Usually, when universities and hospitals and researchers get relatively large grants or awards, they want to publicize what they're doing because it encourages other rich people and groups and companies to donate more money to them. It's
Right.
kind of, that's kind of how it works. It's very, very unusual. Harvard's been silent about that. I can't figure it out, but it doesn't smell good.
Yeah, and so I agree with you, right? It just doesn't pass the sniff test, and it's kind of died out. And the NFLPA and NFL understand that this is how the news cycle works. I mean, at the end of the day, especially working in the business, right? Like, I understand how journalists think. You understand how journalists think about
Right.
covering these things. There are very few
Squirrel!
people
You
out there.
know, we just see the next shiny thing and we move to it.
There are very few guys out there like yourself, Patrick. Like, when I look at your archive, it's all really in-depth. It's clear that you were an academician in terms of your depth of coverage and your interest in intellectual issues that you know, your average sports fan may not care about. Your average sports fan wants to know, you know, who's playing for us tonight and what's the score of the game going to be and, you know, what color are their jerseys going to be and how much is the beer in the concessions line.
Yeah,
And you know,
sports
it's
is an
unfortunate
escape from
because
all these real things. I understand that.
right. So, you know, when you look at this, you wish people would be a little bit more dogged in their pursuit of the truth on these matters. And there's just not much of a market these days for in-depth investigative journalism, which is interesting because I started my career in this space as an investigative journalist, and it's something that I took and take very seriously. But there are realities, and the reality is the business of sports journalism doesn't necessarily value the pursuit of investigative journalism that's not going to click. Okay, so when you look at issues like you're talking about with the Harvard situation, here you are digging around. I wonder who else is digging around. I suspect the Fenerwater brothers are probably doing a little digging themselves.
I think they're trying to follow on that. Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption.
Certainly, and so, but it's a small group of people, and really, it's a big deal. I mean, here you have one of the preeminent academic institutions in the entire world, not just the United States, in the entire world, and they announced publicly that they were going to get $500 million of funding to help with concussion research, and now we find out that it was either a farce or some kind of a gross misunderstanding, and I think it's probably more of a farce than it was a gross misunderstanding, And those institutions, really, as far as I can tell, at least hopefully, they didn't receive much damage from that episode, right? I mean, it was like 48 to 72 hours of, oh my God, look at this, can't believe it, and then you never hear another word about it ever again. And by the time you do hear something about it, it's going to be just one piece of a much broader plot line. You know, like, oh yeah, and this happened, and this is a terrible deal, but here are 50 other things that occurred. Too. So, you know, for Harvard, like, was their association with the NFL a big deal? Of course, they wanted that, right? It helps them, like you said. People become, people who are fans of football and fans of Harvard or fans of medical research, et cetera, are going to be more aware of the research that they're doing and perhaps more inclined to donate to the program, which will obviously, you know, assist them in conducting broader research, maybe in broader realms and creating more good in society. I got to believe that's the base concern, but as with everything, you know, money drives a lot of this stuff. And I think there, it sounds like they jumped the gun and did not conduct sufficient due diligence. Either that or they were complicit in attempting to help the NFLPA leverage the NFL on that front. And in any case, you know, the losers, really, it's not really the school or the NFLPA, because the NFLPA has so many missteps, or even the NFL, there's so many missteps that this is just one of many, you know, whatever, big deal. But the players, they really lose out here, because they need this research. They need answers. They need an expedited
track,
you know, and so you want to see that change, but hopefully guys like yourself and a handful of others out there doing work on these important issues, you know, as you continue chasing after it, people become more aware of the realities of the situation.
Yeah,
you know, you really hope a positive change occurs.
We'll see. I'm glad that you brought up the union. We won't get into a huge discussion now, but one common thread between the stuff with Harvey you're talking about, but also the concussion lawsuits and now these painkiller lawsuits, it's a very fair question to ask. Where was the union? Where were they for all these years? Where are they even now? They're awfully quiet. They've been awfully quiet. And again, you talk about who ends up losing. It's the players and the retired players that end up using. Your union is supposed to protect you. I think that's extremely curious. And I'm sure that's another aspect of this that will be explored and unfold over time. But a lot of people always feel like, you know, that myself and other journalists who look into this, we kind of take the NFL a task, and that's true. But I do think the union also should at least be examined. I'll leave it there. Let's move on to Donald Sterling. Because this just seems like it could, you talk about farce a few minutes ago. This seems like if we're not at the farce point already, we're going to be there really. Like we're at the far. We might be at the farce event horizon at some point here. But he says he's going, and I'm not just talking about him. The possibility of him giving yet another television interview, but just in general, he said he's going to fight the NBA, attempting to get him to sell the team. Is there anything he can actually do under NBA rules to successfully, or even somewhat successfully, fight this, or is he just basically screwed by the rules of the NBA?
Well, you know, I have not really dug into the Constitution. I know that they released it. It had been secret until they had released
right.
it. And, you know, the NFL PA, I know, keeps their Constitution private as well. So there's things that they don't, you know, necessarily want to be public record. I know people are kind of digging into it now from a procedural standpoint. I don't know exactly the mechanism by which they believe they can force him out is, but what I do know, and I think all of us know at this point, is the NBA firmly believes that they can force him out. I mean, they have taken a very strong stance, and they are, at least from a word standpoint, really rattling sabers. Now, there's massive risk And Silver is not a guy who Stern allowed to act as his successor because he was, you know, without ability or without intelligence. This is a guy that, by all accounts, is incredibly sharp, very savvy, and will figure out a way to do what he says he's going to do.
So
because
what
if he doesn't, go ahead.
No, no, you said if he doesn't, what is that
risk? I was
going to say,
he loses absolutely all credibility, right? I mean, this is the first real issue he's dealt with, and what a doozy. And if he doesn't figure out a way to do exactly what he said he was going to do in regard to Sterling, you know, he's dead in the water. And he's not going to be for long because this is a real serious issue. Players are talking about potentially not playing next year for the team or against the team. Players on the opposite side of the country are bandying about potentially sitting out, even if it comes through third parties. You know, these discussions are being had. And it's the last thing the NBA wants to see because they've been in a an unprecedented period of growth. And the game is, or has been at least, extremely exciting and profitable. So,
So if under the NBA Constitution, the NBA's own internal rules, the rules of our club, so to speak, you know, the rules of our organization of franchises here, you know, the internal McDonald's rule, so to speak. We have the power to do this to you, Don Sterling. We can follow these procedures. We're empowered by this specific language, and we can get you out. We can get you to force your team, to sell your team. Moving outside of those rules, if we move into court, right? If we move into antitrust challenge, for instance, things like that, if there's that kind of legal fight, what kind of weapons would Sterling potentially have? You know, what kind of leverage? I'm thinking everything from, like, you know, filing an antitrust suit to, you know, maybe having the ability to use depositions and discovery to embarrass the league office and potentially other owners. What are his weapons? You know, what are his guns? What are his options?
Yeah, so one thing that I think people outside the legal realm really need to understand about the law is you can file damn near anything you want. You can
well,
file
we've seen that with Donald Sterling and his wife and their history. The LA Times has done some good reporting on that. They do go to court a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you can file damn near anything. Now, you know, you have to overcome a motion to dismiss, and you have to obviously deal with, on the attorney side who's filing, you have to deal with ethical issues as to whether it's actually a colorable claim, et cetera. If it's not, you can be sanctioned by the bar. But, you know, let's look at how much money Donald Sterling has. This guy is worth so much money that to him, you know, a lot of people say, well, if you talk to your average person, I mean, let's say somebody worth, you know, $20 million, not your average person, but your average millionaire. And they say, hey, you know, I don't want to deal with litigation. I don't want to deal with why? Because they really are actually involved in that litigation. They don't have the luxury of essentially delegating all responsibility to that litigation. Donald Sterling does. He has so much money that he literally actually doesn't have to touch anything. He just hires an army of attorneys, tells him that he wants to raise hell for the NBA and the other owners because those other owners turn their backs on him, and I want to embarrass them. I want to bring all of their dirty laundry out of the closet and air that out, and he has enough money to do that. You know, and there are ways to get there. Look, the particular legal mechanisms that he's going to use to achieve his intended end are yet to be seen. One thing is very clear. He is pissed. And he doesn't want to lay down here. And you know, when you think about these owners, what's the likelihood that the guy shares those kinds of thoughts in private with Dean Scaviano, that he allegedly used the same or similar inflammatory language, maybe even worse, in the housing discrimination cases?
There's no chance that the league office, you know, didn't read, Peter Keating of ESPN magazine and other people at LA Times and other places that reported on those housing discrimination suits when they came out in the mid 2000s. There's no chance that NBA lawyers didn't look that over. There's no chance that wasn't discussed internally. There's no chance there wasn't contingency planning, PR planning, all sorts of stuff, whether or not it was ever put into place. I mean, that stuff is all somewhere in the NBA vault, I'm supposing.
100%. So then the question I guess I'm driving at is for Sterling on a one-to-one basis, there are only, you know, however many NBA owners there are, 20-some-odd, 30-some-odd owners, and they used to have meetings together all the time. What's the likelihood that a guy that had these strong opinions on minorities never expressed any of those opinions in a private forum? And then the next question is, did those owners, if they heard these things, which I think is probably pretty likely, you know, they heard at some point, he's the longest tenured owner in the entire league. So these can't be the, when you say something in investigative terms, the one time that you're able to publish something, if you can publish it once, it probably happened, you know, 100 other times that you couldn't get to. So it's not the first time. And so I guess my question is, you know, did any of these other owners share his beliefs? We know that these beliefs that he held are not isolated to Donald Sterling. There are other people in the world who believe that way. So it was either condoned or which I think all of us can agree was condoned by not only the owners but the league for a long period of time. But it may have also been, you know, more than just condoned. It may have been supported. You don't know. And Donald Sterling does, though. You know, he remembers those conversations, or we think.
And anything, whether it was supported or condoned, I mean, anything that comes out that his lawyers could dig out is going to be, you know, embarrassing, to say the least, to the league. I mean, it's probably the last thing they want is to get into a long, protracted, you know. I mean, I guess he could go scorched earth, right? he might. And at the end of it, that's the other funny thing. At the end of all this, what's the worst possible outcome? He has to sell the Clippers for what, like over $1 billion?
Right. I mean, he's going to get, I mean, that's the thing, right? So if you think about it from the NBA standpoint, they want to avoid the scorched earth. So, hey, we'll give you, you know, 30% more than the franchise is actually worth or whatever the multiple is in order to make you go away. But I got to believe this dude knows a lot about a lot of these owners. And they've all got, there was an article, I'm sure you saw it. I think it was in maybe NJ.com or somewhere on the East Coast. But they basically laid out, like, look, this is not the only guy in the NBA ownership circle that has issues. A lot of these guys have dirt under their fingernails. And they got some
questionable sort of social, civil rights stances.
Yeah, so it's, we'll see. I mean, it's, put it this way. If I was an owner in the NBA and I wasn't squeaky clean, I'd be sweating right now.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So I want to jump ahead. We're going to skip over the NFL cheerleader lawsuit stuff, only because I dealt with it in depth a couple podcasts ago, and I don't want to keep you on here forever. But I do want to ask you about the Ed O'Bannon case, because it could be going to trial really soon. It could be a couple of weeks from now. And there was a fairly, I think, significant development just last week. Attorneys for the O'Bannon plaintiffs, for the former players, they wrote that none of the plaintiffs want to pursue individual damages against the NCAA. They only want to pursue the antitrust class action case. And so what that would mean is, instead of having a jury trial, we would only have a bench trial with District Judge Claudia Wilkin presiding over, who's been presiding over this case for the last 5 years. In your estimation, why did they make that decision? Why did the plaintiffs decide to only pursue this one avenue instead of both? And what does that mean for their chances of winning against the NCAA when, instead of a jury trial, there could just be a bench trial?
Well, I think with the jury, I mean, you can see this kind of, if you look at Twitter as a cross-section of society, I guess.
Oh, God, I don't know if we should do that, but go ahead. I really hope not. Please, society, be better than that.
Right? I mean, it's scary because the stuff that comes across from those people, which, you know, that's a maybe not directly representative, but somewhat representative cross-section of society. And these are the individuals who are going to be the jury of your peers. Well, you know, these people, bless their hearts, are often so incredibly ignorant, and I won't say stupid, but ignorant insofar as they don't understand the issues. They don't even attempt to understand the issues, and yet they have these very strong opinions. And so something that can draw out visceral reactions like, you know, pay-for-play discussions and college athletes and the purity of amateurism, et cetera, I think that they are much more trusting of Claudia Wilkins, though, the judge's ability to reason through these issues and utilize logic as opposed to emotion to make her decisions than they are just with a regular sampling of society. And, you know, from my standpoint, not knowing everything, but just looking at the facts that are available to us, I think it's smart. She seems to really be a straight shooter. You know, it seems to me that she's much more sympathetic to the plaintiff's sympathetic is probably the wrong word. She's much more convinced by the plaintiff's platform at this point than she is by the NCAA's. But I think most of us rational, logical creatures say, well, that's because it's the side that is on the side of right, right? I mean, you can't argue against these issues from just a pure thing of why.
Sentiment. You can't argue. And that's, you know, that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's, and this is something I've written about before. I think I've discussed on previous podcasts, but if you go back, and I mean this sincerely, anybody out there, go back and look at sort of the case law leading into this involving the NCAA and antitrust challenges to amateurism. If you go back and look at the decisions by federal judges, none of them actually take the normal antitrust, if you are defending yourself against an antitrust claim, or you are actually a cartel, or you're colluding, there are cases where you're allowed to do that if it proves to be the things you're doing are pro-competitive, which basically means that they actually enhance your product, they enhance consumer choice, they sort of are better for the market to exist at all. A classic example of this would be every, you know, electronics manufacturer gets together, agrees to a USB standard. You know, and in one sense, that's a violation of the Sherman Act. They're colluding, but it's okay because a USB standard is pro-competitive. Once you have that standard, you can have all sorts of different products that come out of that, and they can compete, and consumers end up with a better product and more choice and lower prices and all the things that we want and the reasons we have antitrust laws in the first place. The NCAA now has never had to actually prove that amateurism was pro-competitive. There's a right. series of tests, right, that judges usually apply, and the NCAA has gotten away with judges basically saying, yeah, amateurism is great. We really support the concept of the student athlete and the Athenian ideal of a sound, you know, mind and a sound body. And just all this romanticized BS, all this sentiment. And Wilkin seems to be the first judge who said, no, you're actually going to have to come to court and show me economically that not allowing your players to be paid somehow makes your product possible and or enhances it so much that it would be severely damaged without it. And the NCAA, right. I mean, I guess the NCAA is going to try and do that, but that's going to be tough. Most of the economic data out there, most of the economic data that exists that we know about doesn't support that.
Yeah, I mean, they don't want to do that at all.
No, they don't. They want a jury to be like, ew, paying players? That just feels wrong to me, man. Just feels wrong
exactly.
in my gut.
Exactly, 100%. So, you know, when you ask for a bench trial, you're investing a lot of faith in one person, right? And so there are dangers associated with that. But mm-hmm. I think if the plaintiff side is this deep, this close, especially for the attorneys, you know, they're working on contingency fees. There's no money for them in this unless they win. So for them to get all the way down the road and say, listen, we're going to invest all of our faith, we're going to put all of our eggs in Judge Claudia Wilkins' basket, they must be pretty damn sure that she is going to rule in their favor, at least in part, because everything is on the line for them. And you know, I hate to boil it down to that. I do believe that these lawyers, you know, really do believe in the cause, but let's not be mistaken. These are large firms, and mm-hmm. they need to ensure that they bring revenue in the door, or they're not going to have jobs for very
sure.
long. There's a lot of money on the line here. So I would say, you know, in terms of what does it do for their chances, I'm very optimistic that the plaintiffs are going to end up victorious in this matter. To what degree, you know, remains to be seen. But I am for one, looking forward to hearing the NCAA go into court and explain why this system actually makes sense, not from, you know, the platitudes that they throw around and trying to convince the simpletons among us to believe that this is just, you know, I feel bad saying it. It's true. If you still believe that the kids get enough and that they don't deserve more and that they get a free education, et cetera, you're a simpleton. You're either not paying attention to what's going on, you're willfully ignorant, and I just have so little patience for those people. My block list on Twitter is probably 90% people that hit me with free education. I've got people on auto block. It's in their favor.
Yeah, I like that. I'll argue with people, but also I'll just go write something. You know, I follow the Chuck D approach. When I get mad, I put it down on a pad, basically. That's old school rap reference for our older listeners out there.
I love it. Yeah, man, it's going to be interesting. I mean, there's just a lot at stake here, and so I think we're close. You know, we see the Big Five power conferences all saying, hey, we're going to finally start providing cost attendance, and it's time for change, and et cetera, et cetera. You guys are kind of late to the party, man.
Right, well, they would like to be like, look, you can have a bigger piece of the cake, but just let us continue to decide how much cake everyone gets. That's basically what they're doing with the autonomy and making, which, by the way, the things they're proposing are good. They should give cost of living stipends.
Yeah.
They should have better concussion protections. They should allow players to transfer more liberty. These are all things they should have done 25 years ago. There shouldn't be a concession in the first place.
Yeah.
It should just be how you do it if what you really care about is student athlete welfare, supposedly. And shoot me, I just used the term student athlete, college athlete. I hate to use student athlete. Now, I know we're running a little bit on time. Let me ask you, get you out here. One more thing. It involves NFL concussion suits. We had that settlement. Like I said, it's long delayed. It's still in limbo right now. It really looks like a train wreck. In my opinion, a lot of people's opinion, the NFL only agreed to this settlement, is only paying whatever they're going to pay for one reason. They don't want discovery. They do not want it being made public what they knew, when they knew it. Whatever's in there is going to be a terrible PR blow to the league and its leadership, because Roger Goodell was around for a lot of this, all of it, really. Paul Tagliabue was around, and he's still kind of around with the NFL. They're still employing our old friend, Dr. Elliot Pellman, and others who were knee-deep in all this concussion committee shenanigans and BS science. A settlement ends all that. You're the NFL, you get to seal up your vault. Public never gets to know. You're not just buying peace, you're buying silence. All that being said, at least on the silence front, there was this ruling in federal district court last week that might make those things impossible to buy. In the Eastern District of Missouri, there's a case brought by Roy Green and some other former St. Louis Cardinals players, and the St. Louis Cardinals, for everybody out there who's young, are now the Arizona Cardinals. They brought this suit against the team. They didn't bring it against the league. And because of that, a federal district judge concluded that this lawsuit can proceed in state court in Missouri. You mentioned that NFL preemption defense earlier. Because of that, you know, all these other concussion lawsuits have been consolidated in federal court in Philadelphia, where you have the settlement going on. But this one gets to keep going in state court, which in theory means we could have discovery, and we could have discovery no matter what happens in the settlement at the federal level. How big of a deal is that?
Massive. It's absolutely massive. You hit the nail on the head. The NFL does not want those records becoming public knowledge. And so the leverage that they could exert upon the NFL at this point, if they are able to get the discovery, is incredible. If it's $765 million pre-discovery, or threat of actual discovery, what does that number become afterwards? I don't know an exact number, but it would not surprise me in the slightest if you see an increase of 35 to 40% for the simple fact that the possible downside, I mean, they're going to do a calculation, right? What they're going to do is say, how much do we think we'll actually lose? It's the Pinto. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but
yes, I know exactly. Right? It's a calculation that every company that has something to hide and or sells a product that causes public harm does. How much is it going to cost for scandals? It's a Wall Street calculation. Okay, how big's the SEC fine going to be? Oh, it's going to be $500 million. Well, great. By breaking these regulations, we just made $6 billion last quarter. Pay the fine.
Right. Right, and so they're gonna make a calculation. What is the damage to the brand going to be, and where we're gonna go? And with a business that is generating as much income as they're generating on a year-over-year basis, you gotta believe that they were at 765 pre-discovery. The number will be substantially larger with the threat of discovery looming over their head. And for the plaintiffs, even in the Missouri case, there's also a strong incentive to settle. Anytime you go to trial, there are, weaknesses in your case and variables out there that can affect you. And so you want to avoid that if you can. But I look at that as probably the most impactful aspect of this case in the whole time we've been following it. I think it's the most important element of it thus far. because it really finally exposes the NFL to significant PR hit if, in fact, you can prove they did know what was going on. And I think most reasonable people who have been following this think that that will be the case once you get to that documentation.
And one last point on this, just so, you know, in terms of, you said that it's in the plaintiff's interest to settle. It could be. Although, you know, one thing that I think is being underrated in all of this is that there are at least some players out there, and this is, you know, in some ways this is because they're football players, and this is how they've been conditioned, and this is who they are at this point. And it's kind of ironic, and it's kind of like the NFL is dealing with its own Frankenstein's monster in a way, to use sort of a cliched literary reference. There are players out there that this is not about anymore getting the maximum number of dollars out of the NFL, or the maximum of dollars to even pay for their medical care that they need. This is actually about looking at the NFL and saying, you lied, you took a pound of flesh out of me, and now I'm going to get payback. Like, you're going to be exposed. Like, you're going to reveal what you knew, and I don't care if I get a dollar. And that's, yeah, that's, like I said, it's a very football player way to think about things. But it's real. I've talked to some of these guys. It's not all of them. There's plenty of guys that don't feel that way. But there are some players that, like I said, they're past the point of being able, you could buy them off. They actually just want the truth. They feel that much genuinely, personally betrayed. And I think the NFL, if there's too many guys like that, and if they're involved in one of these types of suits, the NFL is in real trouble. On that note, Rayon, I think we, excuse me, I think we're running out of time here. Before we go, how can people find you on Twitter, and where can they find you online to read your writing?
So I can be found at rand_getlin, that's RAND_GETLIN, and then my personal website is randgetlin.com. I post most of my writing there, but find me frequently engaging with the tweeters with Patrick, and looking forward to furthering our discussions. I'm really glad we got a chance to do this, and hopefully we're going to get a chance to do it again soon.
Yeah, for sure. I'll definitely have you back on. Like I said, I'd have you on longer now if we had more time. But it's been terrific. We'll definitely bring you back in the summer. In the meantime, everybody, go check out Rand's work. Definitely, he's one of my favorite Twitter followers. Go follow him on Twitter. You'll really enjoy it. He asks a lot of questions there people don't ask. And he's, like I said, he's quite funny. When he's not blocking people, he's quite funny when he's sparring with them. So I think you'll enjoy that. Rand Getlin, good show. And it's very good that my voice is actually still intact, which I didn't know would happen.
I'm very happy you're feeling better, sir.
Well, we're getting there. You know, just like NFL players, sometimes they got to play hurt. I don't know if a sore throat is quite comparable. I'm not going to go stick a needle of Toradol into my throat when we get off the air here. On that note, for Sports on Earth, I am Patrick Ruby, saying, with a little bit of discomfort, goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.